Perhaps you know the name Srinivasa Ramanujan. He was a mathematician born in India in 1887. And despite having limited formal education, he seems to have made extraordinary contributions to number theory and mathematics. He seems to have been something of a self-taught genius who, while living in poverty, illness, and difficulty, taught himself mathematics from whatever knowledge he could scrounge, and then went on to formulate original theorems of his own that continue to challenge the global mathematical community to this day. His mother kept two college students as lodgers. By the age of 11, he had exhausted everything they knew of mathematics. At about the same age, he was lent a book on trigonometry, which he quickly devoured, while he was already formulating his own original theorems. Like many people of genius, he was completely focused on this single pursuit. He had difficulty finding a job and lived in poverty because of it. He flunked out of his college in Madras because he would only work on the mathematics that interested him and could not complete the language courses and other studies required in a general program. His early publications in the Journal of the Indian Mathematical Society stumped the Indian mathematical community, which did not know what to do with him. Along the way, he recorded his work by hand in four notebooks, which I believe are still in publication in facsimile editions. Eventually, through the support of various mentors, he came to the attention of several professors at Cambridge University. One in particular, G.H. Hardy, recognized his genius and brought him to Cambridge, where they began work together establishing proofs for the many original theorems in the notebooks. A movie about his life called The Man Who Knew Infinity was released about 3 years ago. You've probably seen the movie. It's really worth a watch. It's just for great entertainment, but also a great story behind it. And the movie presents the story initially as a kind of showdown between Ramanujan's preference for intuition and Hardy's insistence on rigorous logic and proof. Whether this tug of war was as starkly contrasted in real life is likely debatable, but what is completely clear is that Ramanujan was a person of deep faith, a devout Hindu, and that divine inspiration played a determining role in his mathematical work. He was devoted to Namagiri, the Hindu goddess of his family, and credited his abilities to her. He persistently testified that she appeared to him in dreams and visions, presenting him with formulas and equations, which he would then have to prove on waking. Describing one such experience, he was quoted as saying, "While asleep, I had an unusual experience. There was a red screen formed by flowing blood, as it were, and I was observing it. Suddenly, a hand began to write on the screen. I became all attention. That hand wrote a number of elliptic integrals." I so rarely see elliptic integrals in my dreams. Do you do that, you people? They stuck to my mind. As soon as I woke up, I committed them to writing. It's quite the dream. He is often quoted as saying, "An equation for me has no meaning unless it represents a thought of God. An equation for me has no meaning unless it represents a thought of God." His mentor, on the other hand, came at mathematics and his life from a different angle. Described as socially awkward, cold, and eccentric throughout his life, G.H. Hardy was also an avowed atheist. To him, mathematics, although beautiful, was entirely a matter of the intellect. The proof was the thing. Intuition had no place. Not only did God have nothing to do with it, to him, there simply was no God. In the movie, this contrast is played to maximum dramatic effect, of course. And as I've said, whether it was quite as stark in real life is open to question. But the fact that it is played that way in this film is telling because it is the deep struggle of our time. For all our wonderful technology, we do not know how to reconcile our highly developed intellects with the highly evolved perception of the divine, which is equally born into us, a capacity which empowers us to an awareness beyond ourselves. The scientific brain is in full ecstatic flight for us now, all over the world, and beautifully so. But we neglect this capacity for the divine atrociously, and this doesn't help us. Doing so shrinks our capacities. We ought to be nurturing it alongside the scientific mind, as many of our greatest geniuses have done. We make a profound error in our belief that the two are irreconcilable. Louis Pasteur, a famous scientist, is often misquoted as saying, "A little science distances you from God, but a lot of science brings you nearer to him." A little science distances you from God, but a lot of science brings you nearer to him. I don't think he actually said it, but I do think there is an insight there. I think of all this today because of the first verse of Psalm 14, which we prayed earlier. It's in your leaflet there. "The fool has said in his heart," says the psalmist, "the fool has said in his heart, there is no God." Probably we have all been this kind of fool at some point. I know I have been. And we've tried on that thought. So be it. The mind needs to question. But for many of us, the thought persists more and more, it seems. One can help but think in this context of Greta Vosper, that United Church of Canada minister who was threatened with expulsion after loudly proclaiming her atheism from the pulpit, I believe. Her claim, I think, is one of honesty, quote unquote. She wants her church to get real, perhaps. And this is what makes the man who knew infinity so important for us now and so interesting. This question, this search, cannot be dismissed, and in my view, should not be. It is not something which is modern and new. Atheism is not something which has just cropped up lately. It has been with us since time immemorial, as the 14th Psalm attests. Above all, science and faith should not be defined by thinking people as mutually exclusive opposites. We would need to commit profound acts of intellectual dishonesty in order to sustain that thought, forgetting or ignoring a vast amount of human history. In truth, the thirst for knowledge that is at the heart of science is born of awe and wonder, a profoundly spiritual impulse. And the scientific method itself was, in the most concrete and empirical sense, born in the monastic communities of Christianity, and likely of other faiths as well. In his excellent book, Modern Physics and Ancient Faith, Stephen M. Barr makes this argument in a way that is literate not only in science, but also in theology, philosophy, and history. Alongside this highly articulate case, his book lists a large number of scientists throughout history who were people of deep faith, many of them priests or monks. Many are household names, having been justly famous for centuries for their profound contributions to science. Nicholas Copernicus, Gregor Mendel, Georges Lemaître, Albertus Magnus, Roger Bacon, William of Ockham, Robert Gross Test, William Kelvin, and Isaac Newton, to name a few of the more familiar ones. A quick Google search will turn up dozens, if not hundreds more, and lists of their achievements. Among Barr's more compelling arguments is that science is not intrinsically at odds with faith, but dogmatic materialism is, and that the two, science and materialism, are often confused. In my view, and I believe it is Stephen Barr's as well, the connection between science, empirical study, and the monastic communities of Christianity is no accident. The deep spiritual practice of Christian spirituality in settled and often prosperous communities over generations created opportunities for human transformation at a very profound level. Monastic communities were founded on deep practices of prayer and work, both in collaborative community and for individuals. Clearly, these monastic communities were not perfect, but they were grounded in a deep practice of peace, specifically the peace of Christ, a peace which the world cannot give. Monasteries often have, large libraries. In them, study was recognized as a form of prayer. The monks were often educated, able to read and write. And this one is very simple, but I think key. They often had enough to eat. They were not worried about where their next meal was coming from. They took vows of stability and so stayed a long time. So they could read and write, they had materials, they had space, they had a lot of time, they had a very ordered, calm life. These conditions very much fostered intellectual inquiry and long-term, clear-headed observation. To say it simply, in monasteries, one could calm down enough to think. The psalmist tells us that we are fools if we say in our hearts that there is no God. Perhaps we are equally fools if we do not bring to our spiritual practice the same level of focus, rigor, and commitment that we expect of those in scientific practice. It may be that in the deep and ancient ways of prayer and meditation lies a great, great discovery, one that Ramanujan knew, that our spiritual capacity to create relationship, even relationship with an entirely cosmic God, our capacity to make that cosmic God personal through sustained relationship, our capacity to trust God, to rely on God, and to listen to God in prayer, perhaps this is among the greatest of all our technologies.